From low Earth orbit to your radio for Thursday, November 29th, 2018. This is another episode of Madison's favorite radio science program, Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Will Cushman. Tonight, we're returning to a topic that our regular listeners will probably remember. We're going to talk about geostationary operational environmental satellites, which is kind of a bunch of jargon for weather satellites that are locked in a stationary orbit around Earth and which conduct amazing science and produce incredible imagery. Specifically, we're going to talk tonight with PNM super guest Tim Schmidt. This is maybe his third time on in just a little over a year, about the GOES-16 and GOES-17 satellites. We're going to talk about how they work, what they're being used for, and how at least one of them is dealing with some technical difficulties and how engineers are hoping to resolve some of those difficulties. Tim is a research satellite meteorologist for NOAA's Satellite and Information Service, which administers the GOES satellites in collaboration with NASA. He's also an honorary fellow at UW's Space Science and Engineering Center. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So first, I want to talk a little bit about you. You mentioned before the program that Madison is, quote unquote, the birthplace of satellite meteorology. So
Correct.
Maybe we could talk about that first.
Sure. So Professor Vern Sumi, a professor in Madison here, was instrumental in working with NASA in the late 50s. So in 1959, Explorer 7 went up, and he measured the heat budget of the Earth from satellites. So that was really the first time that that was done. Vern Sumi's...
Can you explain what the heat budget of Earth is?
Basically, it's a way of saying the energy that's emitted from the Earth of how much, you know. So for example, if the satellite was over a clouds that's colder, getting less radiation versus a warmer desert. I mean, people hadn't done that before, really before that. You know, there weren't the scientific experiments that look down and get this radiation from the Earth. Vern Sumi, when he's doing his PhD defense, looked at the heat budget or radiation coming in out, going out of a cornfield. Well, someone on his committee said, well, now you've done a cornfield, how are you going to do the world?
So you did that. When was that?
1959.
Okay.
So specifically October of 1959. So that predated a little bit the first meteorological imager, TIROS, which is an acronym, was in 1960. So again, that's one of the reasons why he's known as the father of satellite meteorology, and Madison being the birthplace of satellite meteorology.
Interesting. That's fascinating. Could you talk a little bit more about the evolution of meteorological?
I cannot
say that word very well. Meteorological satellites.
Right. Yep. And remote sensing, et cetera. So basically, there are these two main types of satellites. So there's low Earth orbit, or these polar orbiters, as the name implies, go over the pole. It take about 90 minutes, and those are good to give you a view of the entire world. Then there's this other type, this geostationary. They're at 36,000 kilometers, or almost a tenth way to the moon. So they're at this special spot above the equator and rotate at the same rate as the Earth. So when they have cameras looking down, they can get these rapid images. So in 1964, NASA was going to put up a applications technology satellite out into this special geostationary, basically to see if we can bounce satellite signals off it. Well, Vern Sumi, a professor at UW, then said, well, you got to let us put a camera on there, a spin scan cloud camera, so we can watch the clouds move. So his proposal went in 1964. By the end of 1966, built, tested, implemented, launched, and data from space. So that was the birth of imaging from the geostationary perspective. So again, just a research experiment at first, which has grown, you know, not in sophistication in the United States and around the world, you know, with now a ring of geos watching our globe.
Right. So let's talk a little bit now about the GOES R program, which GOES-16 and GOES-17 satellites are a part of, right?
Yep.
So could you talk about the history of that and why NOAA launched these satellites and what NOAA's using them for?
Yep. So I mentioned that we had this ATS-1 in 1966 and ATS 3 was also another one in 1967. Then there were other experimental satellites that NASA was putting up in geo orbit with not only visible sensors, but infrared, or measuring the heat of a radiating surface. So again, how cold a cloud is or how warm the land is. So those were experimental science experiments, but they, of course, had all these uses for operational meteorological forecasting. So then NOAA thought, well, we should have these all the time, not just when they happen to be up as a science. So that's when the GOES program was born. So GOES, Geostationary Operational Environmental Satellite. So, of course, the geostationary is this orbit, operational says, you know, it's not these research ones. And we call them weather satellites, but they do much more than that. And S for satellite. So again, that was 1975, where we give them letters when they're on the ground, and we get this special geostationary orbit, then they get their number. So GOES A became GOES 1 in 1975. So, and then we've had different improvements in spatial, spectral, and temporal resolutions, fast forwarding now to what's the GOES R series. There's actually 4 satellites in the series. 2 years ago today, GOES R got to this special geostationary orbit, and then was known as GOES 16. So again, the GOES R program, or GOES 16 and 17 in particular, are just an advancement, this next generation, than what we've had before. But they're a big improvement of what we've had before, nominally, you know, 2 orders of magnitude or 100 times better.
How so? Like in the resolution of the imaging, or?
Yes, and yes. So
in every way.
So for example, yeah, one of the attributes is how small of a feature can you look at or resolve. So the field of view is 4 times better. So now we can resolve small scale features in the atmosphere or wildfires. So the finest resolution is 500 meters in one of our visible band. And we get that. And so it's improved, you know, spatial resolution. So we can see things not only finer, but we can see things that we couldn't see before. So in some of the IR channels, we have these what are water vapor channels.
IR being infrared.
Infrared. So we have infrared channels that looks at like the heat and the cooling associated with where the water vapor is. Well, now the resolution is fine enough that we can see some small-scale waves, and those may be associated with turbulence for, you know, clear air turbulence for aviation safety. So it's not just we can see things finer, but we can see some things we couldn't see before.
Okay, so small-scale waves in the atmosphere.
In the atmosphere. So maybe when you have a convection or send out some waves, and you can start to resolve that now with the GOES 16 series, but you couldn't with the previous. So that's a spatial improvement. I mentioned we have these different, we have visible spectral bands to collect reflected light, and then we have these infrared bands to collect emitted. Well, we have actually 2 different frequencies for visible light on the GOES 16, 4 in the near infrared, and then 10 infrared or bands that you get at night as well, and that's to be compared to just 5 spectral bands that we had on the early ones. And those spectral bands were chosen so we could see different things in the atmosphere. For example, associated with a volcanic eruption, we can see the SO2 plume often, and sometimes there's ash with
the SO2 being the gas emitted.
Sulfur dioxide emitted with some. So again, we didn't have that capability before. So again, we have finer spatial resolution. We have more spectral bands to see different things. And what's really exciting, we have basically images more frequently. The legacy GOES, we got images for usually every 15 or 30 minutes, which is good. I mean, But with this new ABI, or Advanced Baseline Imager, that's the imager on the GOES R series, now we get images of the whole disk that it can see, or that hemispheric half of that basketball, if you will, if you look at the Earth. We get those at least every 15 minutes. Plus, over the United States, we get that area covered every 5 minutes. And then each satellite has these 2 what are called mesoscale sectors, basically the size of a, you know, medium-sized state or whatever, and we get those every 1 minute. So now we can look at, for example, Hurricane Michael every 1 minute as it, you know, it coming towards landfall, not every 15 or 30 minutes.
Right. So we should say that the GO-16 and GO-17 satellites are pretty much locked in an orbit over North America, essentially, right?
Yep. The GO-16 is our eastern satellite, so that's actually over there at the equator, and 75 east. So that gives you the view of the Atlantic and the North America. And then GO-17, which will become our western satellite, is at 137 west longitude, so a good view of the Pacific and the United States.
Gotcha. So I want to talk about a specific example of a phenomenon that the new GO satellites are helping NOAA make better forecasts or understand better. Can you talk a little bit about how you can monitor wildfires how they start?
Yep. And so, as I mentioned, we have these infrared channels, and one of them is it's very sensitive to temperature. And so, again, that's finer spatial resolution, and that that spectral band is sensitive to temperature. And so when we see fire, when we see a hot spot, there's algorithms that can determine and say, that's just not just a reflection of the Earth, that's actually, and it's by comparing some different spectral bands to each other. So, for example, I mentioned we have this 1 minute mode data. Well, we were practicing with some of that data before it became operational over Oklahoma, and National Weather Service forecasters there could pick out these hot spots. So they tweeted out, hey, there's a hot spot. And in this case, 80% of the time, their emergency managers didn't know about that hot spot, but we detected it first from a tenth away to the moon on this ABI.
Right. So is the early detection kind of the main benefit when it comes to wildfires, or how else can the GOES satellites maybe help with even combating wildfires?
Yep. Early detection's a big thing, especially if they're more remote.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing we can do is then take, and now we know where the fires are, and you can characterize them with how hot they are, what size they are, and then that information can be put in numerical models. So, for example, can then now forecast a smoke plume and then be evicted around, moved around, et cetera. So when you start to say, well, we want to know what the air quality is going to be tomorrow, you really should know where the fires are today, and GOES are a big part of that.
Right. So the recent wildfires out, like the Camp Fire out in California, and the air quality issues in Sacramento and San Francisco were the GOES satellites used for making those forecasts.
Yep. And again, because some of these visible spectral bands, we put a band on to be at a shorter wavelength to be even more sensitive to smoke, which we didn't have on our last generation. So again, you could see where you could see where the fires are with the hot spots, and then you could see the smoke as well better. And then, again, like you say, you can use that for knowing where they are right now, and then get some idea coupled with a numerical model or how what the atmosphere may do in the future.
Right. Can the GOES satellites also help maybe even forecast whether or not like a wildfire is likely due to conditions or winds?
So we could see a number of things. So, for example, you know, we could also see like the heating of associated with the Santa Ana winds with our satellites. Again, so you get
those are the really dry, fierce winds that come in off the Pacific into California.
Actually they go the other way. They kind of go down the mountain, and as you go, you get warmer and you get drier, and then so winds come. So again, you can see those type features. We can also monitor, you know, precipitation from GOES. So then you have the idea of where, you know, it hasn't had a lot of precipitation and those conditions. We can also monitor once a fire was there, what's called if fire goes over a vegetated area, a burn scar. And of course, that's important if you're wanting, if there's, then you get precipitation after the fact for more of a chance for a flash flood condition because you don't have the plants holding the soil in place.
Right. Earlier, you mentioned volcanoes, and I'm curious to talk a little bit, I'm interested to talk a little bit more about how the GO satellites are used in that realm, because when you think about kind of like volcano monitoring, a lot of it is like seismometers, like stuff that's going on deep within the the earth. So how are these satellites that are a tenth of the way to the moon helping with
so we still need monitoring on the side of the mountain, etc. But what we're monitoring is once, let's say you get a puff of ash that goes up in some remote volcano. And so if that's in a flight path, then you don't know that it's there. You don't have necessarily somebody there watching it. And so it's not just as geostationary, but also near their poles, these polar orbiting satellites. A colleague, also a NOAA colleague stationed here at UW, specializes in that. And satellites are really the key because they get that view from looking down, and they can give you early warning, hey, this one's rapidly cooling, and it's got this signature to say it's an ash cloud. And then there are what are called VAC, volcanic ash advisory centers, around the globe that use the satellite data again to warn aircraft, because apparently pilots don't like when their engines stop going if they run into a volcanic ash.
Right. Yeah, that seems problematic. Can we talk about hurricanes and how the GOES satellites are improving hurricane forecasts?
So, you know, there are a number of attributes that, ingredients that you need for a hurricane. You need, you know, warm sea surface temperatures. The GOES can measure that. But you also need the winds in the atmosphere to be just right. Too much of, if the vertical wind shear, if the winds change too much and are too strong, then that's not a good development. But if they don't change enough, then you don't really have the top of the smokestack to kind of move that air around. So you want the winds to be just right. Well, the satellites,
if you want the hurricane to,
if you want the hurricane to, that's right. So the GOES can help measure by tracking features over time, can give you an idea of the wind fields that can also be used. Then, so there's these, so we can use it basically before it develops. And then once it's developing, we can track it all the way across the Atlantic. One other ingredient, if you have a lot of dust coming in, that could be dry air. So then you have less chance of a hurricane develop. But we can also monitor that dust from a GOES satellite, even tracking the dust all the way off Africa, all the way to the Caribbean, sometime to the continental United States. And then, of course, once the hurricane forms, and we can now monitor its intensity from space by looking at how big its eye is in the center, how rapidly it's cooling, the convective cores, in the outer wall. And, of course, we can just use it then to monitor the location and as it moves. I mentioned the special mesoscale or one-minute imagery, and then we can those are relocatable or whatever phenomena that we need to look at. So, for example, we can look at one-minute imagery, of Hurricane Michael as it intensifies, and moves into the southeast, or Hurricane Harvey. We got images from Harvey and Maria and Irma during it. That was from GOES 16, even before it was declared operational. But we could use it and get that information out to people.
Right, yeah. And these images also some animations are available online, right? You sent me a link earlier to some. They're really cool. They're fun to look at. Where can our listeners find those?
As I mentioned, the program that makes these GOES R. So there's the main program webpage is if you search for GOES-R.
So, and it's GOES, G-O-E-S.
Yep. GOES-R. That'll get to a one page. If you also, again, just search for GOES University of Wisconsin. We also have real time imagery here as other ones, both you know, so you can look at those imagery. I also like to remind people that these satellites are your satellites. They're government satellites. So you have to think of a part owner as these. And so, yeah, there are apps to be able to look at them on your phone. I mentioned these different spectral bands and these mesoscale 1 minute images. So you can start to look and see like, well, here come the clouds at a 1 minute time schedule, sometimes over you, but at least probably every 5 minutes.
Right. I want to turn now to some issues that the GO-17 satellite has been having, I understand, since this past summer, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So could you talk about that? What's going on with it?
So, you know, once we launch a satellite, you know, there's a time period that it's in this pre-operational or checkout period, and we've helped with all those GOs. Well, they're infrared detectors in space on the GOs. It looks down, and the problem, and the engineers noticed at first, they weren't keeping as cool as they should, meaning the detectors were getting hotter. They weren't cool and constant over time like GO 16. And so basically that meant, so the visible and near IR bands were working fine, but the infrared at first looked really bleak. So again, half the day, we wouldn't be able to get these, you know, infrared images to look at the heat of the clouds. And that day was actually the nighttime when you really, really need it. So it is a serious problem. Luckily, the engineers have been able to, not fix the problem, at least somewhat mitigate it. So originally, we looked at maybe not having data for 12 hours of the day for none of the 10 infrared bands. Well, that's very serious. Well, now, well, it's not good, but at least three of the IR bands we will be able to get all the time. And some of the times a year, we'll get all 10 of the bands. It's just these two times of the year around the solstice or the equinox, spring and fall, where some bands are more affected than others. So again, it's not a good situation, but we've been able to make a bad situation better.
Right. And that's, so, I mean, when you think about instrumentation and a satellite getting too warm, or I guess I wouldn't initially think that space is such a cold place, but it's because of all the solar radiation that's hitting the satellite, right? When it's nighttime over North America, but the satellite is sitting in the sun's rays.
So think of it as the sun's coming in the satellite's face at nighttime. And then that's the thermal load or that extra energy gets in there. The trick is to move the energy from where the detectors are to this, what's called the cryocooler, and shed that energy, and that kind of link between them is what's not moving enough energy or heat on the GO 17. But yeah, it is ironic that here we're sitting in a big cold vacuum and we're getting too hot for some of the times.
So in a nutshell, how does the diagnostic work, and then kind of the troubleshooting, trial and error, how does that happen?
Well, first of all, it happens all remotely because, again, this thing's up in space. It's 10th the way to the moon, you know, far out there. There's telemetry that comes down. So basically different information about different parts of the, you know, so different temperatures. So
temperatures on the satellite?
On the satellite itself. So it both measures like temperatures of the Earth when the telescope gets radiation from it, but there's also information about different components on what is the temperature of the mirror, what is the temperature of the focal plane modular where these are. And again, it's like any other good sleuthing. It's like, well, looking back at the GO 16 that was working, looking back at data that we took in the lab before launch. And I think it's basically a process of elimination. Well, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that.
Gotcha. And so we only have a few minutes left, but I think this is a nice segue into one of my last questions, which is what is the future of the GOES program? And I understand we were talking about this a little bit before we went on air, that the problems with GOES 17 are kind of informing some last minute changes to the next two satellites in the lineup, right?
Yep. The GOES R series is a series of four. Right. So two are in space and two yet are on the ground. So they'll re-engineer, redesign that loop heat pipe. That's the connecting piece to make sure we're not in the same boat on what will be launched at T and U, which will ultimately become GOES 18 and 19.
Gotcha. And those are going to be launched sometime in the next few years?
Right. Yeah. It really depends on how long this re-engineering takes. But in the meantime, we have, GOES 16 as our operational east. We have 17 up there as west. We also still have and will still operate GOES 15, which is our current operational. It's a legacy system, but it's up there now, and that'll operate at least for the next 6 months. And we also still have GOES 14, which is another on-orbit back up there. So really, as a constellation, we have options.
Right. What is something that our listeners might be surprised about the GOES satellites and how they're used or what they're useful for?
Yeah. I mean, I think just, people often think of hurricanes, and sometimes with the idea that, well, maybe we just turn them on if there's a hurricane.
Oh, the satellites.
Yeah. But again, we're there to see how things are forming. To be able to see things like, fog in the river valleys and people might not know there's also a geostationary lightning mapper on this new one, which gives you total lightning. But when I talk about GOES R, there are actually four other sensors that look at space weather. So looking at images of the sun at six different UV frequencies. So my space weather friends like to tell me that, well, this is really a monitor for space weather. And, oh, we also look at the Earth with, for example, the Advanced Baseline Imager.
Right. So in theory, they could be useful for helping forecast, like, when there's a solar flare or, like, a sunspot.
Yeah, sure. That could... Yep. The space weather also has kind of a similar to a Fujita scale, 1 to 5 for, radio blackouts, this and that. And GOES are really key measurements in two out of those three and help in the third one. They are key for any space weather forecasts.
Right, right. We only have about 1 minute left. So I'm curious to get your take on the other little satellites in the news this week, the CubeSats that were part of the NASA's latest mission to Mars.
Yeah.
What's your take on CubeSats of CubeSats?
Yeah, it's an exciting time. I mentioned these two different types of orbiting satellites. So I think CubeSats make sense in these polar orbiters. It's cheaper to put up there. They'll come down. Still, these geostationary tend to the way the moon. It's still pretty expensive to get there. And I don't think the CubeSats will replace our GOES anytime soon.
Cool. Well, Tim, thanks a lot for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
And we want to thank everyone who listened tonight as well. PNM is produced solely by volunteers. If you think you'd be interested in helping us in any way, literally any way, please do not hesitate to email us at scienceonwort@gmail.com. That's one more time, scienceonwort@gmail.com. This has been another edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine, brought to you by the Madison Science Radio Collective. Thanks again to our guest, Tim Schmidt. Our show tonight was engineered by Kevin Lauderjung, and I am your host and producer of tonight's show, Will Cushman.